From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And you may have heard on Morning Edition, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly gave an exclusive interview to NPR's John Burnett. They talked about a wide range of issues, including the Russia investigation, North Korea, and also immigration. We're going to dig a little deeper now on that issue of immigration with some of the interview you haven't heard. And John Burnett is here. Hi, John.
Hey, Jeremy.
And let's listen to another interesting clip from your interview. Kelly was laying out his thoughts on people entering the country illegally with a different tone than President Trump.
The vast majority of the people that move illegally into the United States are not bad people. They're not criminals. They're not MS-13. But they're also not people that would easily assimilate into the United States. They're overwhelmingly rural people. In the countries they come from, fourth, fifth, sixth grade educations are kind of the norm. They're coming here for a reason, and I sympathize with the reason. But the laws are the laws.
John, that is the first time I've heard about the rural background of immigrants being used as a reason why they shouldn't be allowed to enter the country.
I mean, what's interesting about his answer is that he spoke more compassionately on the one hand than we hear from the president when he has this polarizing rhetoric. Almost any time he talks about immigration and all these people that are coming over here and doing all this damage to the U.S. And then you heard in the same answer, Kelly said these people are not like us and they have these, you know, poor educations and they don't assimilate well, which I think is also very much reflective of the thinking of the White House. As we know, they want fewer immigrants across the board, whether it's temporary protected status or refugees or legal immigrants or undocumented immigrants. You know, I thought it was an interesting answer where he kind of balanced both sides.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that this administration has been talking about is separating families caught crossing the border illegally in order to discourage people from doing that. And there was a policy shift this week from the Department of Justice that would actually make that the policy of the U.S. Let's listen here to John Kelly. And this is the first time we're hearing this audio.
A big name of the game is deterrence. If
and so family separation stands as a pretty tough deterrent.
Could be a tough deterrent. A much faster turnaround on asylum seekers.
Even though people say that's cruel and heartless to take a mother away from her children.
Yeah, I think cruel and heartless, I wouldn't put it quite that way. The children will be taken care of.
Yeah.
They'll put into foster care or whatever. But the big point is they elected to come illegally into the United States. And this is a technique that no one hopes will be used extensively or for very long.
John, this is a pretty significant policy shift.
And actually, the first time we ever heard about family separation to be used as a deterrent for migrants coming up from Central America and crossing the border illegally was from John Kelly a number of months ago. And at the time, people were horrified that he would suggest it. And here it is. It is now U.S. policy that if a family crosses the border illegally, immigration agents will refer them for prosecution. They'll arrest them and they will put them in a federal jail for crossing the border for a number of weeks, and they will take their children away and put them in these juvenile shelters elsewhere. And the administration very much wants to use this as a deterrent to scare potential immigrants down south from coming here.
One of the central pieces of this administration's immigration policy has been the idea of a border wall. And you asked John Kelly about that and the additional National Guard members placed at the border. Here's Kelly.
Physical barriers work. You know, Mr. Trump from 2 years before he became the president-elect was talking about barriers along the border. He acknowledged the fact way back then that this was not going to be a concrete wall from sea to shining sea, that there were places we didn't need a wall. There's other places, particularly where you're close to cities on the U.S. side, where you very definitely need a barrier. You know, the border barrier system from the Pacific Ocean along the California border cut illegal immigration by 97%.
Now, the White House doesn't seem like it's budging on this issue, but neither is Congress. What do you think is going to happen here?
Well, what's happening is that in its fiscal year 2019 budget, Homeland Security has asked for 200 more miles of border for wall, and that will, I think, be concentrated, as Kelly said, in the populated areas. that don't already have a border wall. So it's far less than what the president wants, but they're going to keep coming back and back and back and asking for more miles of the border wall. So it's a little – we're kind of unsure, you know, where this thing is headed, mm-hmm. but they seem to be pretty committed, you know, to continue building these barriers as Congress appropriates the money and, as Kelly said, mainly in the urban areas.
That's NPR's John Burnett, and there was a lot more to this interview. We've got a link to a transcript of the entire interview at hereandnow.org. John, thanks.
Sure, Jeremy. Happy to be here.
Well, tomorrow, Iraqis will choose a new national parliament that will form their country's next government. The election is the first since the Islamic State was defeated in Iraq last year, and it will determine whether Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi keeps his job. The threat of violence hangs over the day. A candidate was murdered on Monday. NPR international correspondent Jane Arraf joins us from Baghdad. And Jane, it would seem obvious that there's a lot at stake, but what exactly is at stake in this election?
Well, pretty much the future of this country. And although you could say that about any election, in this one it's even more true because they're going from a country that's been essentially at war for 3 years to one where the big task now is reconstruction. So it's all about can they elect someone who can fix the economy and bring jobs back. And it's also about the fragmentation of political parties. So for the first time, you've got a lot of different Shia parties, different Sunni parties. There's a much wider choice.
We'll talk about the threat of ISIS because we've had reports that this candidate was assassinated by ISIS. But what's the latest on that?
Those were early reports, it's true. It turned out, though, that he actually, according to the police, was killed by his relatives, including his son. So anytime someone's murdered here, there's always a variety of possible suspects, whether it's ISIS or criminal or gang-related or tribal. But that doesn't mean that the ISIS threat has gone away. They have indeed threatened to attack polling stations. They're trying to warn away voters. They don't want this vote to take place. And they have said they will attack. But Iraqi security forces and actually the Americans advising them seem pretty confident that that won't be the case on Election Day.
Well, but just to take up the murdered politician, that's quite sad. And we were reading accounts that his cousin said of him that he wasn't the normal politician in Iraq. He wasn't handing out cell phone company gift cards or giving cows and sheep away to get elected. And just off of that comment, is it thought that this is going to be a fair election?
If you look around the region at elections, there aren't a lot of elections that really are elections. Like the Egyptian one, for instance, it had 1.5 candidates, basically. This one, you have a variety of candidates. You have a polling system that has been vetted and worked on with the international community. So actually, amazingly, maybe, this does seem to be a real election. That doesn't mean it's not flawed, and that does not mean that there are great candidates to vote for. But as for the election process, the big concerns are there are still almost 1 million displaced people, most of them Sunni. And the Kurds will have lost seats because the dynamics have changed. But really, one of the exciting things is this is an election in the sense of people having a choice.
Well, and what about Abadi? In office since 2014, the year ISIS swept across Iraq and Syria, does he deserve credit for the defeat of ISIS?
He's certainly taking credit for the defeat of ISIS, and certainly he does deserve some credit. He was commander-in-chief of the armed forces. But, you know, victory is claimed by a lot of people. So the other person who's taking a lot of credit is the head of the former militias, the paramilitary forces, who is Abadi's main rival. His name is Hadi al-Amri. And one of the dynamics has been when ISIS came in, the Iraqi army collapsed in places. So there was a religious call saying that Iraqis should come and fight ISIS. And Iranian-backed paramilitary groups, along with lots of others, heeded that call. So now you've got the head of the former militias saying that it was his people who defeated ISIS. So that is a running theme. But Abadi will get credit for defeating ISIS, and he will also get credit for taking back areas that had been under control of Kurdish forces, because that's another big development that's happened in the past few years.
Well, you've been talking to Iraqis ahead of the election. What are you hearing from them?
There is a common theme. They're tired of war, and they want to live normal lives. And by that, they mean they don't want to be here in this country which is a wash in oil and be worrying about getting a job or how to put food on the table. I was at the voting for the Iraqi security forces because that took place a couple of days before. And all of these people, most of them who had been in battles fighting ISIS, came and they voted, and a lot of them said they want to see change. One of those was a federal policeman, Sergeant Muntasar Hadi. He's 35 and he has 4 kids, and he was saying that he wants his children to grow up and have a future. He wants to see new faces, and that's something you hear a lot. They don't want the same old politicians who they believe to be corrupt. They want new faces.
A policeman in Iraq speaking to NPR international correspondent Jane Araf about tomorrow's elections. Jane, thank you so much for covering it for us.
Thank you, Robin.
The reaction is still coming in, and it's angry, to that leak from a White House staff meeting yesterday in which staffer Kelly Sadler said it doesn't matter whether Senator John McCain opposes the president's CIA nominee because he's dying anyway. Here's one response on Twitter. Are there any Republicans left with a soul to stand up to something this repugnant? Femi Oke is co-host of Al Jazeera's The Stream. She joins us to talk about how the news filtered through social media during the week. And Femi, this exploded. Sadler reportedly called McCain's daughter, Megan, to apologize, but the White House hasn't commented. What are you hearing?
Well, the White House has a statement. It doesn't reference exactly what Kerry Sadler actually said, but it does say that we respect Senator McCain's service to our nation, and he and his family are in our prayers during this difficult time. Meghan McCain retweeted her words from The View earlier on today, and she says, "Don't feel bad for me or my family. We're really strong. My dad's actually really well right now, and I believe in the power of prayer, and I think it is helping." But there's a lot of bipartisan support for Senator McCain, and Hutch Waterfall really sums this up on Twitter. He says that comment, "What a disgrace. I don't agree with most of McCain's policies, but have a heart."
All right. Well, that's going to continue. That is not going to die down soon. But we want to turn to someone who fascinated us, and now he's gone. David Goodall. He was the 104-year-old Australian scientist who went to Switzerland to end his life because assisted suicide is illegal in Australia. He was in pain. He held a press conference saying that he regretted living as old as he did.
Well, I'm not enjoying life now as I would have done 5 or 10 years ago. And I think the same may be true of most people of this age.
Femi, this really reverberated online.
It was stunning, and also stunning because the family got together with a news organisation, Sky News, and they documented his journey to death, his journey to die. So every moment was posted, what his last meal was, what the drugs were. You could look at the drugs. You were told how he could turn the drugs on or turn the drugs off, depending on whether he wanted to go through with this. Robert Fairhead watched this story unfold online, and he said, "What a beautiful testament to a life well spent and the decision to end it. Thanks for sharing, Goodall family." I'm not sure that people changed their positions, but what they did get to see through this playing out of David Goodall's life was what it is like to be 104 years old, what it's like to say, "I am going to die on this day," and how to actually do it, and takes away the mystery out of it and perhaps the horror that some people may associate it with actually deciding, "I am going to die and I want to do it now."
Quite a story. Well, we also have to get to the video that came from behind the new single from Donald Glover, Childish Gambino, that blew up the internet. It's been viewed more than 75 million times. It's called This Is America. You first see him cheerfully dancing through an empty warehouse. It looks like the warehouse that Thriller, you know, the garage that Thriller was in. And then, boom, he's shooting a man point blank. He continues to dance through a room filled with church choir singers. Let's listen.
This is America. Don't catch you slipping, no. Don't catch you slipping, no. Look what I'm whipping.
So he comes to the choir and then shoots the choir with what appears to be an assault-style weapon. Femi, you know, people are going crazy, you know, all the references in this. What are you hearing?
So many. And there are so many companion pieces, companion videos online, companion articles, think pieces, the hidden meaning to This Is America. And what makes this a cultural conversation is just the sheer numbers of people who are looking at the video and trying to work out what it actually means. One tweeter says, Sarah Richards says, I might be responsible for 200 views on YouTube. The conversation of this video is instigating, is absolutely electric. And people are talking about it, people are sharing it, people are analysing it, and talking about how this form of music, that hip-hop, this style of hip-hop, can actually give out a really strong message, that hip-hop artists can actually change the conversation in America, inform it, and have and resonate in a very clear way. There's one comment which I really want to share with you, because if you want to go online and see This Is America, there's a point in the video where it stops for about 17 seconds, and that is in memorial for the students who were shot in the Parkland shooting. So there's so much to look
so
at.
So much.
That
are
caught,
his pants, that Confederate soldiers' pants. I mean, there are African dance steps, Jim Crow references. It's amazing. Femi Okeh.
More than a video.
Yeah, it is. Co-host of the stream on Al Jazeera. We'll post it at hereandnow.org. Femi, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, HBO's Barry wraps up its first season this weekend. The show stars Bill Hader as a hitman trying to turn over a new leaf as an actor in Los Angeles. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans is a fan. So am I. Eric, great to have you.
Yeah, good to be here.
And you've called Barry the best new comedy of the year. What do you think makes Hader's performance as the title character so compelling for you?
Well, what's interesting to me about this is that, number one, like, Bill Hader is the star, and he's also well-known as a mimic and well-known as a comedic actor, but he's largely the straight man in this comedy. And the rest of the characters are kind of zany and crazy around him, and the comedy comes from how he reacts to them and how they react to him and how they misunderstand him in many key parts. And this sounds like the type of show that you would think that you've seen before, but this is a very different story. He's trying to be part of the LA theater scene, which is very kind of marginal. And what Bill Hader said, I saw him talk about this in Los Angeles, and basically what he said was, what if the thing that you were really great at is the thing that's killing your soul? And the thing that you want to do is something that you're terrible at. And so this is what we see play out with Barry, where he's an amazing, almost a savant of an assassin, but it is literally curdling his soul. And then he tracks a mark, someone he's supposed to kill, into an acting class, and he suddenly decides this is something he wants to do, but he's so closed off from his emotions that he's terrible at it. And so they play with that a lot, especially in the early parts of the show.
Well, and some of the biggest laughs come from Henry Winkler, who plays Gene Cousineau. That's the actor teacher of this class you're talking about. Here he is doling out some advice to Barry.
Life is about taking a risk, making the unsafe choice.
Okay. All right, here's a little story just to illustrate. I once auditioned for the guy that robbed the house on Full House, and I carried a loaded Beretta with me into the audition just to feel the weight of it.
Wow. Did you get the part?
Oh, they freaked out.
I remember another moment when he said that in order to feel sad, he would think back to when Princess Diana died. I don't know why I thought that was so funny, but tell us more about this cast.
Well, once again, we're sort of reminded about how good Henry Winkler is. You know, people who only know him as the Fonz on Happy Days, you know, are missing the boat. This is a great comedic actor. And, you know, he plays one of the most over-the-top characters, this guy who is kind of a schlub everywhere in real life. You know, he can't even get these bit parts on these TV shows, but in this acting class, he is the king. And he also has this wonderful romance with a police detective who winds up looking into the eventual murder of the guy that Barry tracks into the acting class. And she's played by Paula Newsome. And they have this unusual romance that kind of blossoms over the length of the show. And it's great to see a middle-aged black female character get to be sexual on TV. when she's not in the Shonda Rhimes show, right? So, and then finally we have these great characters, these gangsters that he deals with, especially this character named Noho Hank, who is played by Anthony Carrigan. He's a not-so-bright Chechen gangster, and he hires Barry for a job, and then later when Barry hesitates to kill the guy, he tries to kill the guy and also tries to kill Barry, and then they wind up having an argument about it. Let's check out that clip.
I'm quite a bit angry, but I'm going to put that aside for now because rage is counterproductive, yes? And I know if the situation were reversed, I probably would have done the same thing you did.
You did do what I did. You tried to kill me.
Okay, well, now we're getting a little he said, she said.
The Chechens are the best in this show. I love them.
And then, you know, later or earlier, you know, when he tried to get Barry to close his deal and kill somebody, don't kill him until we have a bullet delivered to the guy through DHL. And I have a little app to track when he's going to get it. Just like these are the dumbest criminals around, but they're also great comic foils. But the show, you know, takes a turn toward getting more serious as it plays out. And that's good because they've prepared us by letting us get to know these characters in an environment where things are lighter so that when it takes a darker turn and Barry does some pretty extreme things to protect his secret, we're still invested in the characters, especially him. And in a way, we're almost rooting for him as he does these really awful things to try to keep his secret. They've really thought out this series.
It's a great show to watch. And again, it ends this weekend. And people, if they haven't even started watching it, maybe they can go back and watch it from the beginning. It's a lot of fun. But Barry's ending. There's another show that's debuting. And just in the minute we have left, I would love to ask you about that. That's Showtime's Patrick Melrose. It's based on a series of novels and it features Benedict Cumberbatch as a traumatized aristocrat. What do you make of this show and its depiction of the idle rich?
Yeah, so the novels, the series of novels that this is based on were kind of a literary sensation. And so it was a big deal that Benedict Cumberbatch decided to do a TV show where he plays this character, this son of wealth who was abused by his father and dealt with horrible addictions because of it, but tries to come out of it and build a life for himself. It's very well done, and it's a very pointed commentary on the hazards of inherited wealth, which is kind of important since we're living in the age of Trump, and our president is also an example of someone who inherited a lot of wealth.
So another show to add to the list, Eric, that just keeps growing of great shows to watch. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thanks as always.
Thank you.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
The National Football League has taken some steps in recent years to protect players from concussions. And if you have a kid in a youth league, you know they are as well. Well, now the state of Tennessee has established a rating system to help parents better understand which leagues have the best safety standards. And the NFL's top doctor has pledged to help spread Tennessee's program across the country. Blake Farmer from member station WPLN in Nashville reports.
The Gallatin Soccer Club is one of just a handful of leagues to achieve Tennessee's Safe Stars Gold designation, the highest level.
And are y'all's socks over y'all's shin guards?
Yeah.
And are y'all wearing shin guards?
Student referee Abby Bodie makes a bunch of 5-year-old boys tap their shins to prove they're protected. It's something you'd see on just about any kid's soccer field. But risk director Shane Davis says the difference now is that pregame policy has been put down on paper.
The things that we were already doing that were, club known, the stuff that we just, everybody knew you had to do it, it had to be in writing.
Davis says there's a tough-it-out attitude in some youth leagues that many parents no longer tolerate.
All of our kids play, and we love our kids, and all of us coach. Nobody wants to see anybody's kid hurt.
But meeting all the standards did hurt the nonprofit league's bottom line. The most expensive component is buying an AED, a defibrillator machine. Davis says that was $1,200. But health officials say an AED needs to become standard. It's required even to meet the minimum safety level of bronze. Alex Diamond is a pediatrician who helped design the rating system.
Those criteria on that bronze list are responsible for 90% of the deaths that we see in youth sports. And so if we can even just make a dent in that, we're making a significant difference.
At the launch event for the Safe Stars program, referee Travis Childers recalled stepping in to save a boy's life who collapsed during a basketball game. He used an AED that was stored in the gymnasium to revive the boy.
His coach had this deer in the headlight look, and that's something that needs to change.
All of it demands much more from volunteer coaches, background checks, a plan for a sudden allergic reaction, and at least two coaches per league certified in CPR. They're even required to commit to creating a positive environment. The regulations also mandate training for coaches to recognize the signs and symptoms of concussions and setting a policy for when kids can return to play. Leagues also have to explain how they intend to prevent concussions. Former NFL defensive lineman Albert Haynesworth says his own sons have football coaches that don't seem to care about safe tackling or avoiding unnecessary collisions.
I have to figure out some kind of way to vet these guys at being coaches, because just because you got free time and you got a son on the team doesn't mean that you're a coach.
The NFL is starting to embrace this new certification program in Tennessee. Alan Sills, who's a neurosurgeon at Vanderbilt Medical Center, is also the league's chief medical officer.
Let's get to where parents demand this for their kids, for their schools, and for their youth leagues.
Sills says he'll do all he can to involve the NFL. The Players' Union made a similar commitment, with a representative calling it a way to save the sport. For Here and Now, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
This week marked the birthday of the 33rd president of the United States, Harry S. Truman, born in 1884. Truman is remembered for ordering atomic bombs to be dropped on Japan to end World War II, but his presidency represented much more than that. We explored his legacy last year when we visited the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library in Independence, Missouri. One feature of the library, a replica of Truman's Oval Office from 1950, which includes portraits of George Washington and Franklin Roosevelt. I spoke with the museum's director, Kurt Graham, in the Oval. He explained why Truman kept the space in front of the fireplace open.
The reason for that is because he used this as a press briefing room as well. He brought the entire press corps into the Oval Office. He referred to them as boys because they were all men. These boys, you boys, come on in. He would bring them into the Oval Office, and he would make an announcement or read a statement or take questions, and they would climb up on the furniture to get the right photograph and everything. It was a much more casual use of the office than you would expect today.
I was reading a quote of his. He said something like, you know, it's not always easy to come out here and answer questions from the press when I don't know what the questions are in advance. But I'm glad that the president has to do this, and I hope that this continues for a long time, that the president has to answer to the people.
And Truman did. He answered to the people very directly. I sometimes refer to Harry Truman as the Will Rogers of the American presidency. He had these earthy, pithy quotes and little one-liners, often very agrarian in their origins because he was a farmer from Missouri. And he very much had that kind of approach. And he didn't shy away from questions, you know, and he didn't shy away from decisions. He made major decisions throughout his administration, and he didn't seem to be bothered by the fact that people would be second-guessing him.
It's a truth that Truman would become known for. Graham shows me the sign that famously sat on the president's desk, the one that says, "The buck stops here."
It was on his desk here in this Oval Office. We don't know that it was ever on his desk in the real Oval Office in Washington. It was something given to him later. But it does, I think it stuck to Harry Truman because it represents both his decisiveness and the number of important decisions that he had to make. But it also, I think, is a reflection of his character. Instead of blaming someone else, instead of trying to look for, you know, a reason that it's not your fault, it's, you know, somebody else is responsible for something. Truman said, no, the buck stops here. I take full responsibility. And he did for his decisions.
He actually lived up to that.
He absolutely did.
Perhaps the most consequential decision Truman made came on August 6, 1945.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima, and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy. That bomb has more power than 20,000 tons of TNT. The Japanese began the war from the air at Pearl Harbor. They have been repaid manyfold, and the end is not yet. With this bomb, we have now added a new and revolutionary increase in destruction to supplement the growing power of our armed forces. In their present form, these bombs are now in production, and even more powerful forms are in development.
Is that the main part of his legacy, or what do you think?
Well, I guess if you look at it in terms of the amount of material that's been written about that decision, it could easily rank as that. Truman did not see that as a major part of his legacy. He started his presidency, and within 4 months, those bombs were dropped and the war was over. And then he had, you know, basically two terms to fill, full of all kinds of legislation, all kinds of interesting things going on. So Truman, the interesting thing about Harry Truman is he made a lot of very important decisions, but he didn't second guess himself. He didn't lose a lot of sleep. He didn't wring his hands over those kinds of things. He made his decisions and he moved on.
Another decision he made was to bring the U.S. into the Korean War.
Very costly decision from the standpoint of popularity. He leaves office in 1953 with some of the lowest poll ratings. I think it was 32% of any modern president. But it was a very courageous thing. He did that to support the United Nations, for one thing. It was not an American war. It was something done under the banner of the United Nations.
He opened the United Nations also.
Right, he did. It was something that obviously Roosevelt had things underway. One of the first decisions he made as president. And they asked him, should we continue this thing in San Francisco with United Nations? And Harry Truman said, absolutely. And he went to the United Nations and opened it and gave a big speech there. So he was very committed to the idea of the international community.
For it is a declaration of great faith by the nations of the earth, faith that war is not inevitable, faith that peace can be maintained. If we had had this charter a few years ago, and above all, the will to use it, millions now dead would be alive. If we should falter in the future in our will to use it, millions now living will surely die.
What about domestically? What was his legacy on domestic policy?
Well, Truman was someone who was, I believe, way ahead of his time in a number of issues. Civil rights, for example. You know, when you think of civil rights, you automatically think of Lyndon Johnson.
Right.
But it's interesting that Lyndon Johnson gave a lot of credit to Harry Truman. Here at the library, we have a tape of Johnson calling Harry and Bess Truman on Christmas morning, 1968. And he tells them that he's been given a plaque of all the legislative accomplishments by his staff, of things that had happened during his administration. And he says, you know, about half of those things happened under the Truman administration, or got started under the Truman administration. Whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, you know, the idea of universal health coverage. There's so many things that Truman does that you look back and you realize that he was way ahead of any kind of civil rights movement or anything that would later come.
Was there anything about Independence, Missouri, or about Missouri that played out in his presidency? Is this place important to his legacy?
Oh, it's very important. It was incredibly important to him. I think being a man from Missouri, being someone who really came up from the bottom. I mean, he was truly a self-made man. He couldn't afford to go to college. He went broke in various businesses. I mean, he did not have the advantage that you would think that someone who would arrive to be president of the United States would have. He's one of the last presidents that you can look to who really sort of came up through the ranks by his own effort and his own merit.
What do you think he would think of President Trump?
You know, I don't know that historians tend to look at change over time. And, you know, the Trump presidency is still current events. You know, we often quip when we get that question. We say, well, anything Harry Truman would say about the current president, we probably couldn't repeat on the air, you know, because Mr. Truman had colorful language. But no, I think time will tell. You know, again, Harry Truman is the one that brought America out of isolationism. The idea that the United States is in a leadership position vis-a-vis the free world.
He even ran on those themes in 1948.
The record on foreign policy of the Democratic Party is that the United States has been turned away permanently from isolationism, and we've converted the greatest and best of the Republicans to our viewpoint on that subject. The United States has to accept its full responsibility for leadership in international affairs.
It seems that we could be retreating from some of that. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, you're going to have to get 25 or 30 years beyond the moment and look back and see.
But he probably wouldn't like hearing somebody bash NATO or the United Nations.
No, one of the interesting things that makes this such a fascinating time to be in the Truman business is so much of what Mr. Truman put in place together with Churchill and other leaders seems to be up for grabs in a way that it never has been before. But here at this library, I've had ambassadors from places like Korea, from places like Eastern Europe, come here and say that Harry Truman deserves credit for putting in place the architecture, the structure, the scaffolding that has held up a system of unprecedented peace and prosperity, not just for the peoples of America and Western Europe, but for the entire world. So when you see that being questioned, when you see that a retreat from that, or you see that being dismantled, I mean, you do sort of pause and you wonder, well, what is the next thing? Is this the wise thing to be doing or is it not? And again, only time will tell.
When Truman left office, he had historically low approval ratings, as we heard. His popularity, however, has increased over time. He's now considered one of the most important presidents in American history. And even though their views of the world are very different, with the last name Truman, his new alphabetical neighbor in the history books will likely always be Trump.
Let's catch up now on the R. Kelly controversy ahead of his concert tonight in Greensboro, North Carolina. It's still on despite a campaign to cancel it. And yesterday, the music streaming service Spotify announced it will remove R. Kelly's music from its popular curated playlists. You have to find songs like this one yourself.
I believe I can fly. I believe I can touch the sky.
Beautiful song, dark story attached. R. Kelly has been repeatedly accused of mistreating and abusing women and teenage girls, including in an explosive report from BuzzFeed last summer, running something of a cult. His lawyers deny it all, but the hashtag #MuteRKelly is growing. Jeff Edgers is national arts reporter at The Washington Post and host of the podcast Edge of Fame. And Jeff, you spent a lot of time with Tim and John Jelen Savage. Now, they say their daughter, Joy Selen, now 22, is one of those being held captive by R. Kelly? Tell us more.
Well, they're a family in Atlanta, and it's a very complicated story. But basically, the Savages brought Joycelyn, when she was 19, to meet Kelly. She's an aspiring singer, and they thought he could help her career. He ended up getting her his phone number, and they started a sexual relationship that her parents didn't find out about until, they say, later. And they really found out when they went to, get her at college, and she had emptied her room and was now living and traveling with Kelly. And so since that point, the last time they saw her was December 2016. This has played out privately and also somewhat publicly. And the Savages have actually also had some contact with Kelly. Here's an interview I did with Tim Savage where he's explaining what it was like talking to Kelly on the telephone one time.
I talked to Mr. Kelly on March the 1st of 2018, and he told me that trust the process to see my daughter. How can you tell a father that haven't seen his daughter in over 2 years to trust the process?
Well, we can hear the father's pain, but she is 22. So why is this so disturbing to people? And for one thing, she's not the only young woman living and traveling with him.
And there's also a history here dating back decades. And we reported that in a very lengthy report in The Washington Post. But, I spoke with six women by name who had previous relationships with Kelly that they described as abusive. What they describe is sort of an MO that isolates these women, that preys on very particular girls, young, African-American girls who come from broken families and really don't have much else going on. And it's very stark when you hear them describe the idea that they're kept, separated from his normal pop, music life. They're kept in rooms. They have to get permission to use the bathroom. And they have to call him daddy. It's very, very disturbing stuff. I talked to one woman, Asante McGee, who lived with Kelly and ended up being sort of the whistleblower. And this is what she had to say.
Once he see that he have you where he wants you, then that's when he start doing the punishment, not feeding you, locking you in rooms, and, telling you. Basically, he makes you think that people are watching you.
So, Jeff Edgers, what is R. Kelly saying about this?
So Kelly hasn't actually spoken in an interview. I asked for months to meet with him, and I actually found him in Detroit at a hotel in a lobby and went up to him, and he refused to talk to me. But he sent out a statement to me at 1 in the morning right before we were set to publish, and he basically said, quote, that he has close relationships with a number of women who are strong, independent, happy, well cared for, and free to come and go as they will. His people have called this protest against him a public lynching. So he's had very strong words, and there's been no sense that he feels there's something that he's done that's wrong.
Well, and you've spoken about things that have happened over the years. There was a young girl who said she was having sexual relations with Kelly when she was 15. That was settled out of court. There was a sex tape allegedly made with a 14-year-old. He went on trial for that, charged with child pornography, found not guilty in 2008. And he was married to R&B singer Aaliyah. When she was just 15, reportedly, his manager helped get her a fake ID. And here's an exchange about the age of these young women with Ture in 2008.
Do you like teenage girls?
When you say teenage, how are we talking?
Girls who are teenagers.
Jeff Edgers, this is also blowing up because of the Me Too movement. You have people like John Legend, Ava DuVernay, Viola Davis, all getting on this mute R. Kelly hashtag. What do you think is going to happen here?
It's hard to tell exactly what's going to happen. His concerts are being protested, but in some cases they're taking place. Chicago was canceled, but Greensboro is on. One interesting thing I've found is that while there have been many celebrities of color, really, who've come out and voiced their support for some kind of action against Kelly, we haven't seen that same level of support and awareness from white celebrities. And so I am curious about where this leads. RCA Sony, his record label, has remained basically silent on this.
Jeff Edgers, national arts reporter at The Washington Post, host of the podcast Edge of Fame. Jeff, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on that. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.